From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack, and I'm flying solo this week because Evan Dawson is taking a well-deserved vacation. But as usual, it was a busy week on the show, and we'll start off this week's podcast with a discussion about the impact of Hurricane Maria. The storm ravaged Puerto Rico more than a week ago, leaving the entire island without power. And even though recovery efforts are underway, many members of our community say they're still having trouble reaching their friends and family on the island. In this clip, you'll hear from two members of the local Puerto Rican community about the fear of not knowing where their friends and family are and how they're doing. First, you'll hear from Maria Delgado, a nurse whose husband is working with FEMA on the island. And then you'll hear Isabel Cordova, an associate professor at Nazareth College. Both have immediate family in Puerto Rico. Here's Maria.
I am completely worried. I know that Puerto Rico is devastated from the little bits that I speak with my husband, from the little bits of text that I do get from him. I was able to connect with some family members. And the great thing, I have to give a shout out to Facebook. I know a lot of people do not like Facebook, but I, for one, you know, all that I could contribute right now is looking at my Facebook at 6 a.m. between 6 and 7. And then before I go to bed, I just, you know, look through Facebook. And this is how I'm contributing. I look to see who I can connect. I did not hear from my brother, Arthur, in Puerto Rico. And I put my Facebook public. And within like 5 minutes, I got a response. I know your brother. He is okay. I'm his cousin on his mother's side from a cousin in, you know, he told me the town. And I was like, wow, this is just wonderful. And I was overjoyed. So I said, you know what? I'm going to do this and start connecting everyone else. So I just scroll when I see a story of someone is missing or, you know, they haven't heard from someone or they need a ride to the hospital or something. I just put it out there. And that's how my connection is right now.
I've found that experience happening with some friends and family as well. My cousin has family in Puerto Rico, and he's doing the same thing you are. He's reaching out, trying to make connections. So Facebook, very valuable at this time. Isabel, what's your experience been?
I think I've been pretty lucky. I've sort of felt like I've been almost in the hurricane from the beginning because I have a WhatsApp sort of chat group with most of my cousins in Puerto Rico. It's a cousins group, and it's very active. And for the entire time when the rain started and the wind started, they were all on and communicating, and there was a lot of movement. So pretty much through the evening and into the night, when the hurricane arrived, I was kind of listening to their voices and sharing the tensions. They were getting very nervous and talking about how the noise was increasing and how a window just flew and I can't stop the water. And so in one way, it was very nice. In another way, it was very disturbing. And then the silence that followed was really disturbing. And then there's a few of us in the, you know, continental U.S., spread through Texas, California, New Jersey, and Rochester, and my sister, for example, in North Carolina. And we pretty much stayed abreast of things and sent a lot of information out to them. And then because most of my family is from the San Juan metro area, you know, a lot of the power, a lot of the ability to get like phone signal, or which is very spotty still, but was much better in San Juan. I have a brother in Vieques, one of the islands off of Puerto Rico, and it took us almost the entire week before we knew from him. That was really difficult. We sort of assumed he would be okay, but, you know, not hearing and not knowing, and then not even getting to the point that Maria is describing of being able to see somebody on the safe list that could say, but we were definitely using all of our Facebook, WhatsApp, all of the kinds of social media, which were really active and really helpful to try to locate people. So after everything had kind of passed, little by little over a course of several days, we sort of started finding out at least one person that knew of somebody, and then news would spread. And we've accounted for everybody in my immediate family, finally. It did take quite a while. But again, I do think we're sort of in a privileged group of people because of access in and out of San Juan and also the United States. So,
the silence just has to be terrifying.
It's unnerving, definitely.
I think, this is Maria speaking now, I think the worst part is the silence of just not knowing. Mm-hmm. And I still haven't heard from a few family members and friends. But I have faith that they are as fine as they can be. Right. And I know that the people in general of Puerto Rico are resilient. And I know that we will overcome this, but it's going to take years before we can have Puerto Rico the way that it was before.
Next, a conversation about science and religion as they relate to abortion. Dr. Willie Parker is an African-American abortion provider in the South, and he's Christian. He joined me on the program to talk about his new book, Life's Work, and why, as a man of faith and a doctor, he supports women's reproductive rights. Many evangelical leaders would look at his work and say that, as a Christian, he's wrong, that his views on abortion do not fit into the model they understand. I asked Dr. Parker how he would respond to those leaders, and here's what he said.
Well, I would respond respectfully and say first that we're all think alike, none think too much. And I certainly respect their right to dissent. I won't let their right to dissent stand in the way of my respect for their right to hold those views. But I think my book is about, I saw a cartoon that I think captures best what I think the real tension is. And it was a woman talking to a man. And there's a balloon over the woman's head. And she answers the question that the man She answers in response to something the man said. And the man said, apparently, you came from my rib, intimating that the creation story about how humans got here. And she looks at him and she says, I didn't come from your rib, you came from my vagina. And so it's a humorous story about a scientific understanding of reproduction and one, a non-scientific. And so the tension, as Dr. King described it, is that there is really no tension between a scientific understanding of reality and a religious one. They're just different understandings. Dr. King said that science gives humankind knowledge, which is power. Religion gives humankind wisdom, which is control. Science deals mostly with facts. Religion deals mostly with values. The two are not enemies. And so to the degree that I hold with the best integrity that I can a scientific understanding as a clinician and a scientist and a faith identity as a Christian is to the degree that I've been able to reject the false dichotomies and to say that when I need scientific answers, I ask scientific questions. When I need religious or spiritual answer, I ask religious questions, and the answers and questions are not interchangeable.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes at the center of that debate is the issue of personhood. Mm-hmm. And that word itself has become a flashpoint in many conversations, with many people of faith arguing that personhood begins at conception. How do you define personhood, Dr. Parker?
Well, personhood is not a biologic term, but in terms of a stage of development that is recognized with regard to sentience, with regard to autonomy, with regard to bodily agency and integrity, personhood is conferred at birth. That's how the Constitution defines personhood. And that's how many religious traditions, even in Judaism, when the first breath. So there are religious understandings again, and then there are scientific ones. And so people, when they say life begins at conception and personhood begins at conception, well, they're conflating scientific and non-scientific terms. So if you say life begins at conception, the problem with that is in order to have a live conception, you have to have a live sperm and a live egg to get a live conceptus. So if the sperm and the egg have to be alive, obviously life began before conception. And what that speaks to and what I'm getting at there is not being flippant, but is to say life is not an event, it's a process. Life began millions of years ago, whatever we want to define that as, and that process is playing out and it's going to continue to play out. And it plays out whether any particular individual decides to procreate or not. So what I insist on is respect, but I respectfully disagree and make sure that if you want to have a policy conversation and we're talking about science, that understanding does not hold water. If you want to say that that's your religious belief and understanding, there's no rebuttal to your belief and understanding. I will hear it and I will respect it.
Now to a conversation about accents, or should I say accents, specifically the Rochester accent. Yes, if you live in Western New York or as far away as Cleveland, you might hear that flat A as part of your speech. Maya Abtakian is a professor at the University of Rochester, and she's studying the Rochester accent. She joined me to talk about her work and how we sometimes view some accents or dialects or ways of speaking as superior to others. We talked about how different ethnic groups often have their own vernacular, but how one is not, quote unquote, better than the other. So maybe you'll hear some people say ask, while others, typically African Americans, say axe. It's called African American Vernacular English, And in this clip, Abtakian discusses how the two vernaculars came to be and the value society assigns to them. Let's listen.
One thing that I like to tell all my linguistic students in intro classes is that those two varieties, Askian and Axian, have, and actually Jane probably knows more about this than I do, but those two varieties have been around and in variation since at least Old English. And in fact, I believe it's the case that Askian was the preferred variant for some period of time at least.
Possibly. I don't know off the top of my head. I worked on pronouns.
In any case, the point being that those two variants have been around for a long time. And again, nothing inherently better about one over the other, except that one just ended up sort of, you know, I mean, we assign value to variants, to dialects that have nothing to do with anything about the structure of the dialect. They have to do with our associations with the people who speak them.
So how can we remove that stigma? That's a big systematic change. Maybe that's too big of a question for this hour, but when we have educational institutions, the media, yep, pushing, you know, what's
movies,
considered, Hollywood,
Disney,
absolutely,
yep,
pushing what's correct, quote unquote, and what's not. Yep. How can we overcome that challenge?
Well, I think one thing that we can do is at least start with raising awareness about the fact that, you know, what I said earlier, there's no inherently superior dialect to another, right? And raising awareness about the systematicity of different dialects. At an institutional level, what I would like to see and what I try to do to the extent I can in my classes and so on is the acceptance of different varieties in contexts where they might not have been accepted before, right? So in my class, as much as I can, I try to have students writing in their own dialect, in their vernacular form of English. The problem with that, of course, is that that may not be accepted elsewhere. And so there, you know, I know a lot of teachers will say, but I have to teach my students how to use standard English because otherwise it's not going to be accepted elsewhere, right? And I think that is one of the major things that we could work to change.
Finally, let's close the week with what has probably been my favorite interview throughout my almost 2 years on Connections. I spoke with Sonia Manzano, and if you don't recognize her name, you will probably recognize her voice. She played Maria on Sesame Street for 44 years. Manzano was in Rochester for an event with the YWCA, but first she joined me on the show to talk about her childhood, specifically her educational experience and how it paved her way to Sesame Street. Manzano grew up in the South Bronx as the daughter of immigrants. Her father was an alcoholic and he was often violent, so Manzano turned to TV as an escape. She was an A student in a school in the Bronx, but that changed when she transferred to a different school in Manhattan. Here's Manzano explaining how that experience helped her become an advocate for early childhood education and a show like Sesame Street.
I was an A student in the South Bronx. I would phone it in. I would give myself manicures in my desk and still answer questions and still be an A student, but it was because very little was expected of me. If I just showed up and didn't get into any trouble and I wasn't a felon, I could stay in the smartest class track. They had a tracking system. If you were considered smart, you stayed in the smart groove your whole educational career. But if you weren't, if you didn't speak English or you were disabled, you were put in the low achievers class your whole career. Well, I was in the very smart track, and I was quite shocked then, as you can imagine, when a lovely teacher suggested I audition for the High School of Performing Arts, which was the Fame School. They had a television show about it, and there was a movie about it. And mm-hmm. It's a real school in New York. Now it's called LaGuardia. But at that time, it was the High School of Performing Arts, and this teacher suggested I try for acting. And I got accepted, and my grades went from I went from being an A student in the South Bronx to a C student at the High School of Performing Arts because I couldn't compete with the middle class educational careers that these kids had. I didn't know how to debate. I thought I couldn't tell the difference between a debate and a fight. I couldn't write. I didn't know what a noun was. So I wasn't prepared like these kids had been prepared. And maybe that's why I'm such a proponent of early childhood education. You get those basic skills or it's very, very hard to catch up. So that's why I went from an being an A student in the South Bronx, I thought I would kid to myself, how could I have been so smart in the Bronx and so stupid in Manhattan? And that's why I decided to continue my education by going to schools that accepted you on an audition. But it points out how our educational systems are so disparate, and we haven't closed the education gap like we hoped that we would, which was an original Sesame Street mission.
Absolutely. And the target audience for that show, Sonia, if you can just help us identify
the target audience for Sesame Street in 1969 were underserved African-American children. The idea was if these kids started school with the cognitive skills that their middle-class peers had, they would start school on an even level. And it was through illuminating self-esteem as well, showing a diverse society, which Sesame Street certainly did. We were going to help close the education gap and improve, obviously, the racial dynamics of America. I remember quite clearly, you kind of intimated this, when I was a student at Carnegie Mellon University, and I walked into the student union, and there was a very bald, on the television set, a very bald, very young James Earl Jones reciting the alphabet. I thought, what is this about? This is weird. I thought it was a show about the lip reading. You know how he enunciates so deliberately and the letters were flashing over his head. And then the real shocker came when they cut to the street. And as you said, I saw what's my neighborhood doing on television? And then I saw Susan and Gordon. And this was a time when you never saw people of color on television. And if you did, they certainly weren't this beautiful, lovely couple. So that was really shocking. And then I was cast on a show 2 years later because of activism, because everybody had a platform at that time. Everybody had a political platform at that time. And Mexican-American activists on the West Coast demanded Latino representation on Sesame Street, as pronounced as African-American representation on Sesame Street. And that's how Emilio Delgado, who plays Luis, and I got cast. Thank you, thank you, thank you, West Coast activists.
And that does it for another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. We're also on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks for listening all week, and thanks for listening to this podcast. We will talk to you on Monday.